You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cutts.
Friends, part two of the four-part series, The Four Dynamics That Infect Every Relationship. Not just your human relationships, but also two of the relationships you don't think much about, your relationship with yourself, which most of us don't actually think much about, and your relationship with God, which is a relationship that I think what happens is we tend to treat it like a whole different category. But actually, these four dynamics infect human relationships, relationship with yourself, and relationship with God. Before we get to the four, and the one we're focusing on today, just Jimmy and I today. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, I've got a new microphone, by the way.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a less shiny version of yours.
It looks good. I like the matte black.
Yeah. So we'll also see if our subscriber numbers increase through the vocal quality of the host.
That would be a good thing to track.
Yeah, I think so.
Worth the time.
Yeah. So maybe you'd like to subscribe. And in doing that, I've just done what I used to do with our Christmas services. Do you want to explain to our listeners what used to drive you crazy when we'd lead Christmas services together?
Sure. Yeah. It was my responsibility to kind of figure out when we should do these services. And so when we tracked the attendance, Steve would say, hey, you know what? Why don't you come to the 3 o'clock this year? And so then we would have no idea if the 3 o'clock was busy because Steve asked everybody to, or if it was because it was a convenient time to watch a Christmas service.
And if I recall, year after year, I would generally change which service I'd be throwing people to. Yeah. Yep.
Lots of useless data.
Yeah. So in the same way, whether subscribers go up because we asked or because of my fantastic new vocal presence, we'll never know.
We may never know.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing to note, folks, before we light our candle, two things. Lisa is in the basement. We're up on the second floor, but she's doing a trauma intensive right now. And then the other thing that means that my life-giving dog, Brody, who doesn't really like to be alone, may be visiting the podcast. He just left, but he was with us. So, and just for our listeners to know, if he visits, it's probably because he wants to play fetch right here on the air. So we'll see how that goes. Every time you come over, he kind of wants you to you know, engage. Okay, folks, the candle today, the olive oil, thyme, and patchouli. Hey, this is from our friends at Sojourn East in Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah, guys, we've still got your candle. You gave us so many of them. We're just working our way through this one. This is a single wick candle that we just light by faith. Remembering what I think what I'd like to focus on today is John 1:14, that the word became flesh and dwelt among us. In the Message version, the way Eugene Peterson puts it is he moved into the neighborhood. And then one of my favorite preachers, Lewis Smeads, he says he packed his toothbrush and his sleeping bag with him. So he came to stay. Mm. So just a reminder, guys, that it's never the wrong time to relax into God's presence. Okay, so in this series, we are doing the four dynamics that infect every relationship. Last week, we did assumptions. Yeah, as you reflect last week, Jimmy, on assumptions, anything, oftentimes we'll record and then we're like, oh, I wish I'd said this thing. Anything for you about assumptions?
How about everything that I said? I've gone through that.
Have you listened to it?
Just remembering, you know, like, man, this would have been a much better example is usually the way that my brain works. Hey, Brody.
Yeah.
Man, I think that one of the ones for me is that... oh man, you need to go first because now I'm focused on Brody and I'm all verklempt.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so assumptions, the simple idea that assumptions infect relationships and they put you in a false reality. I think what I've been reflecting on is they just never go away. I've been doing this work so long and it's still for me a daily battle. What I'm working on right now is if something's missing in the house, my brain tries to blame someone.
Mm. Yeah.
Rather than me saying, I bet I left it somewhere.
Yeah, I can relate to that. It just came to me, Steve, that the one that I think was, I mean, it's so prevalent in my life is that I believe that everybody should be aware of their impact on the environment they're in.
Yeah.
That shows up every time I go to drive, you know, of like, man, can you not tell that you're in the far left lane and there are all these people waiting to get by? Like, I would never do that is my response in my head that makes me angry.
Yeah.
But it's everywhere, right? It's like, how can you be so unaware of the impact that you're, the negative impact that you're having on the room or wherever you are?
Yeah. Yeah, discourtesy continues for both of us to be an insane trigger. It's really wild.
Yeah.
Okay, so last week we covered assumptions. You guys can go back and listen to that if you didn't grab it. The other three dynamics are reactivity, stuck patterns, which we'll get to in a whole episode, but basically recurring predictable patterns either in your life, like when you just get tired of yourself because like, oh, there I do that thing again. Mm. Or what often happens is we find ourselves having recurring predictable patterns in our relationships. So the stuck patterns, that's the third one. And then I'm excited about the fourth one, attempted solutions. That's going to be a fun episode.
Oh, yeah.
And Jay Haley famously, the therapist famously said, I don't address problems, I address your attempted solutions. And yeah, we've both been there as well.
Absolutely.
Today we're talking about reactivity. I actually had two kind of consults this week. One was with a pastor who's newer to ministry, or at least newer to the lead role, and has been caught off guard by the amount of criticism he's getting.
Yeah.
And he grabbed me this week just for some time, and he's like, I know I shouldn't take it personally, but I do. I should get over it by now. And then he shared that he loses quite a bit of sleep, usually over an email.
Yeah.
So that was one. And then another one was a Christian leader who, she was using a home place example where she said, whatever's going on with her spouse and kids, she listens to their feelings and then feels all their feelings. Then they walk away and she's left feeling all the feels.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on either of those that you want to tackle first of all?
Golly, just that it is so prevalent. You know, it's these things. I think we talked about it last week of this idea of memento, of waking up every day. And there it is again. I need to use tools or practices or spiritual practices to help me pay attention to the goodness of God. And it can feel like you're stuck in a pit and that there isn't a way out, but there is.
Yeah. Yeah. So for the pastor, I advise people to get out of bed. If they're going to lay in bed awake and worried, I would rather get up than lay there and do more of the same or a stuck pattern.
Yeah.
So one of the things that helps me is I play guitar. I've got a couple of guitars right here within reach. And then another thing that helps me, Jimmy, is I'll actually watch some stand-up comedy. And I find that laughter can help. And I think what's important for our listeners, we try to remind them of this, the anxiety is going to come back. Mm. These are not solutions that make it go away, but they just give you a little relief.
Yeah.
So right now I'm on a Gary Goldman binge.
Okay.
A great comedian. Mm. And I don't know which one I'd recommend. He has a great stand-up, I'll just say. On the day he found $20 in his coat, in a winter coat he put it in his closet.
Yeah.
And then he tried to prorate, how much would Bill Gates have to find
for him to be excited?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great bit and I won't spoil it. But he basically, the premise is I have an experience that Bill Gates will never get to experience.
Yeah. That's delightful.
Yeah. Gary Goldman.
I mean, Nate Bargatze is where I go these days.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to beat. He just got back from Australia. He did a tour in Australia. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Okay. What about this lady that feels all the feels? What might a brave practice be for her? Because I think the temptation for us is to think that, oh, I should do something and never feel the feels. But we normally advise like a little incremental thing.
Yeah, I think it is important. Just like what you said of getting up and whether it's watching comedy or doing something on your life-giving list. I mean, there is long-term work to be done, right? Especially once we get reactive, it's going back and looking at why and taking the time to figure that out. But man, that's long work. And what we often need is some immediate awareness or reminder of the presence of God. So I know I talk about it a ton, but the candle is so tangible for me, and it's not always possible to do that reactively. But that's one thing that I go to pretty frequently these days.
Yeah. So she could, if she knows that she's in a predictable pattern of catching all the feelings, she could light a candle before dinner just for herself.
Yes.
Or she could do it for the whole family. She could also name to the family. If she wanted to be brave, right? Hey, I'm working on, like, your feelings are not the problem. Me catching them is the problem.
Right.
So share what you want to share, and I'm going to practice just for this one meal.
Yeah.
She could have a team.
That's so good. And I think that you had talked about this another time, Steve, but doing this in the family, especially your family of origin, is probably the toughest environment.
Yeah.
Right? And so it very well could be that is the move, to practice by naming the dynamic in her family. It also could be that she could find an opportunity where she's prone to catch her friend's feelings or other scenarios where she's prone to catch feelings and anxiety and practice there first. To where it's a little bit more predictable, maybe it's a little bit more safe. She may be a little bit less reactive in those environments.
Less umbilical cords flying around.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, really good advice. So if the person who reached out, if you're listening, maybe find a group where you tend to catch their feelings, but they're not your kids in this case or your spouse, which then relates to this pastor with criticism. Oftentimes what we prescribe is go meet with a difficult person on purpose, mostly for the sake of noticing yourself. Like you're not blowing them off and you're not, you know, exploiting a critic.
Yeah.
But I've done that where I'll meet with a critic and really pay attention to what's going on in me.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this pastor, he may not meet with the person that wounded him most recently. He might pick a safer critic, but that could be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So today's dynamic is reactivity, and we both have trouble defining it. So I wonder if we could try describing it. What is it? What does it feel like?
Yeah. I mean, in my opinion, it's our automatic reactions. I know reactivity, it's in the word, but it's the things that we almost don't get to decide first. They just kind of sneak up on us.
Yeah.
I think it's the surprise of them is what makes me identify it as reactivity, is it's not a predetermined thing that I've thought about, but I catch myself reacting. And there's this emotional response that surprises me.
Yeah. And oftentimes what people get confused by is the range of responses, I think. So like anger, mm-hmm. if someone's taken up the left lane and there's a stream of cars behind them, I move to anger and judgment.
Absolutely.
Those are both reactive moves, but it doesn't feel reactive. It feels fantastic.
Especially if you think you're right.
Right.
If you're on the side of righteousness or your idea of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if I had a rewrite on my book, I would have named it Managing Leadership Reactivity because I keep running into particularly, frankly, male leaders that say, I'm not an anxious person. So if you're working with someone and they said, I don't think I'm anxious, like that team member I have, she's always anxious, but I'm not anxious.
Mm-hmm.
How would you help them discover their anxiety?
It's really tough. I mean, it would depend on the relationship that I have with that person on how quickly we get there. But really the goal would be to get them to realize that if they don't feel anxious, a lot of the times they have people around them that are actually absorbing their anxiety.
Yeah.
And so they don't carry it. They just put it on everybody around them. And that can show up as reactivity as well, to where they're getting reactive. And so everybody else is responding to their they blow up in anger or whatever it is that they do that feels great to them, but it causes anxiety in the people that are around them and they're the ones that carry it.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're listening, I mean, it's most of our listeners haven't been with us this long and still think they're not anxious.
Yeah.
But maybe you work with somebody that just is oblivious and it's because they're the one generating most of the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the challenge, right? Is if the team, particularly if the team is lower in the hierarchy, like how do they put that anxiety back on the boss without getting fired or making it worse, which is why they stay in that stuck pattern.
Yeah, that's a really tough position.
Yeah. And then that reinforces the narrative, the assumption of that leader. The other thing I run into with reactivity is if that leader has been leading a long time, everything that they had to do to get the organization to that place often involved a lot of unaddressed reactivity.
Mm.
And now they say, well, this is what it takes. Like
right. You
all have to deal with it because this is how we get here.
Yes.
What do you say to that?
Oh man, I'm a deliberative processor. So that's what's happening is I'm thinking I was talking to somebody recently that was really frustrated with kind of that cultural dynamic. It was speaking to that end of this is what it takes to be a part of this organization. And sometimes that can be really good. And I think that's what's so insidious about some of these things is that a lot of them are based in good things, good pursuits. I know that my own idols and reactivity, a lot of it is maybe some part of it is redeemable or good. It's usually the extreme execution of it that's the bad part. And it's difficult to detangle those two, find the good and be able to mitigate that extreme implementation of it, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So reactivity, if you're looking for it in your own life, one thing is like a extreme emotion, shows up. Anger, judgment, shame. That's a big one.
Yep.
We'll get to this more later in the episode, but one of the simplest ways we teach people is to notice when you've gotten bigger or smaller. We'll cover that.
Mm-hmm.
A simple way to look at your reactivity is when someone has violated your values. Like for us, it's courtesy.
Mm-hmm.
And just in case you're wondering, I remember we both worked with a couple of people, one of whom really valued efficiency and productivity. She would even say, we are on staff because people have tithed. Right. So therefore, we must be very productive to respect their tithe.
Right.
Then she worked with somebody who valued safe space. Like, my desk is a place that you can plop down and spend all the time you need to be well. And if I need to blow through deadlines, I will.
Yeah.
Those would be examples of good values. But those two ladies never got along.
No. And, you know, I was in operations at our organization. And one of the patterns that I could see very clearly is almost this, boiled down to its simplest form, it's people-focused people and task-focused people.
Yeah.
It feels like neither could see the value in what they put their energy towards. And both assumed that the people-focused people assume the task-focused people didn't care about people.
They're not fulfilling the Great
right,
Commission.
Right, and then the task-focused people believed the people-focused people, that's a lot of using the word people, they didn't care about efficiency or productivity, or that they just thought they just, you know, were wasting the good people's tithe.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so reactivity, you can pay attention to your strong emotional reaction, what puts you into shame, and what changes your size. And then this is more advanced work, Jimmy, but we also try to help people notice when they've stopped noticing God's presence. Because
mm-hmm.
reactivity puts you in a posture of self. So you either need to survive and shrink, or you need to dominate
right.
and take over.
Yeah.
Which you talked about last week, kind of the idea that we decide God's not doing God's job, I'll take it from here.
Right.
That's a sign of reactivity as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, here's what's interesting about it is most people think of anxiety as worry and fear, but oftentimes reactivity, I mean, it can feel like worry and fear, but it often doesn't, right? It feels like, sometimes it feels great.
Right, yeah, especially if you're being reactive about like the example of the left lane, you know? It's clearly I know best, and the best thing is for that person to move over so we can all pass. And so my anger feels righteous. And so it doesn't, I mean, obviously road rage, it can get extreme.
Yeah.
And once it gets to this extreme that then alerts some other part of us, if I shouldn't behave like this, then we can recognize it. But if it stays under that threshold, it can feel yeah. like the right move.
When Lisa and I were engaged, my parents flew over and they came for my college graduation. Then we went on this big road trip and I was driving. We got to a national park. I think we were in Montana. And there was like a pull off for the, where you drop people off in the driving and this car in front of me pulled off and stopped, and I stopped, and like 2 minutes, we're just sitting there and I'm about to lay on the horn because discourtesy.
Yeah.
And that's when I see them pull out a wheelchair, helping this poor person get in their wheelchair. And I'm like, what a jerk am I?
Right.
Cause I was assuming.
Yeah.
And then filled with reactivity. Couldn't manage my reactivity. Didn't even know I was reactive.
Yeah.
But I was proud of myself. I didn't lay on the horn, but I did in my head, and Jesus says it's the same thing. So it's kind of a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're fundamentally talking about here is chronic anxiety, false need. It's driven by assumption. So in our four dynamics, when you operate out of assumption and your assumption is not corrected or challenged, or if you're not curious about it, what shows up next is reactivity.
Yep.
You get filled with reactivity. And that means we get bigger and smaller. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, I think it's one of the simplest ways to start noticing reactivity, both in yourself and in other people, is that it's a pretty simplistic category of you can tend to get bigger and smaller. Of course, we all do both, but usually there's a tendency we have of the tool we use to try and regain control of the situation or whatever. And so bigger, an example that I have, I mean, really a general example is any time that my kids aren't listening to my wife. Respect is a big—
Respect, yeah. Yep.
And so I get bigger, which is silly because I'm already so much bigger, literally, than an 8 and a 10-year-old. Like, I don't need to get any bigger for it to be effective. But I find myself, getting bigger to ensure that they understand what's expected and required in my house, right? Which sounds terrible. The other example that I have is that I play softball. It's co-ed softball. It's the least competitive version of that that you can do in our area. So it's just supposed to be for fun. But we have this guy on our team, we'll call him Mike. And he was an incredibly, he's a great player, very enthusiastic, but he had to take a season off because he injured his shoulder surgery. So he's in the dugout cheering us on every game, even though he's not part of the team. Mm-hmm. We're on the field and he's in the dugout and an ump gets a call wrong and he's a stickler for rules. So he starts yelling at the ump about the bad call. And I'm on the mound telling him to chill out. He doesn't, and I start walking towards the dugout, and with every step, I'm getting bigger and louder until it ends with me toe-to-toe with him in the dugout until he finally relents and realizes that this isn't how we do things. You know, and I feel comfortable doing that because I think I'm right, right? And the ends don't always justify the means, but that would be an example of me getting bigger.
Okay, let's play with that second example. First of all, let me toss a flyer. Were you by chance raised in a home that valued respect for the parents?
Absolutely. Yeah. No question.
Yeah. And so, you know, another episode for another day, but family of origin, right? But this raises a really good thing. Like when I'm listening to these two examples, number one is, well, what's wrong with respecting mum? Which of course the answer is nothing. And the second question is, well, what's wrong with giving a rec level ump a break? But that's not what you're talking about. What you're getting to is overreaction.
Yes.
This is really important, I think. Respect is good, but dominating your kids every time they disrespect is bad. Help us with that.
Yeah. I mean, one part that I omitted from the story that brings me deep shame is one of the things as I was walking and yelling was, "You're not even a part of the team." Which, you know, I wish I could take back, right? And I was trying, you know, in a poor way, was going, man, like, what is this? Where is this passion? He was getting bigger, right? Out of reactivity. And where is this passion coming from that is not commensurate with what happened? Like, why do you care so much about us being wronged when you're not even on the team? Now, I had to pay for that, right? Like, I apologized and said, man, that's not what I meant. I was trying to help you understand that this was not a right-sized reaction. And mine was the same, right? Like I think I was either trying to match his size or get bigger to try and gain control.
Yeah. Your heart was actually good. You were trying to protect the ump.
Right.
And team cohesion. It's a rec game.
Yeah.
So I've got an interesting contrast example to this that might help our listeners, I think. Okay. When our kids were playing rec soccer and even competitive soccer, same situation.
Yeah.
But in kids' sports, sometimes the stakes are really high.
Yes.
Just as an aside, my own view of this is that the parents' behavior has been so terrible, we've run off all the good refs. Mm-hmm. And so Romans 1 teaches us that God hands us over to our desires.
Yeah.
So we get what we deserve. Like we have no room to complain nowadays because of years of abusing refs. But I watched this situation where one of the opposition's grandparents started accosting a ref, and one of our parents, who's a rugby coach, he just gently walked over to that granddad on the other team. Mm-hmm. By this time, it's kind of funny, Jimmy, the granddad unzipped his jacket and was flapping his jacket at the ref like a bird. I guess he just was using whatever tool, but he was unleashing on the ref. And Nick, this rugby coach, was just quietly saying to the granddad, "Is this what you want to do? Is this getting it done?
Wow.
Are you wanting to get kicked out? He was just using curiosity. It was quite remarkable to watch.
Oh my gosh.
And it didn't end well. The granddad was not able to manage himself. He was all infected with reactivity.
Right.
So the idea of stepping in and protecting a ref and helping, that's good.
Sure.
It's the overreaction, right? That's the problem with reactivity.
Yeah, which is what makes it so insidious is that I still felt like it was the thing that needed to be done. But you know, I know that the whole team was going, cause I'm not generally somebody that shows up that way. I don't think that I'm that way naturally.
Right.
And so they're like, whoa, what's going on? Right. You know, like,
right.
I didn't know that was inside Jimmy, you know, and that this would bring that out of him.
All right, let's talk about getting smaller. So I'm like you, I tend to get bigger. And just as a general statement, you and I are tall guys. We're majority culture. We have big voices. We're generally going to get bigger. That's the general rule. Mm-hmm. But I was at Andrew's basketball game when he was in high school a couple of years ago. And we were playing one of our big rivals and we were on their court. So we were the away team. Okay, one of our star players goes up for a layup. And the other team flagrantly fouled him. They actually elbowed him in the hip during the layup. They turned him sideways with their foul, and he landed on his head.
Whoa.
It was terrible. It had to be carried off. And the ref didn't even call a foul.
Wow.
It was bad. Bad call by the ref. I've already covered that. So the ref misses it. I'm fine with it because the Romans won, because I'm a good theologian. But the kid's dad, he was sitting right behind me. And if you know, like, bleachers, his knees are in my back, mm-hmm. right? And he starts screaming, the dad does, on our team. And he's screaming at the ref. He's screaming at the kids. He's using horrendous language. Okay. Then he stands up. And now he's ready to physically fight. And by the time security intervened, he's in the other student section, the home team student section.
All right.
Ready to rumble with minors. It was awful.
Wow.
Afterwards, Lisa said to me, Steve, I'm really surprised you didn't do anything, which I think is wife for do, right? And I get what she's saying. She's like, you're a 6'2" Australian. You can handle yourself. Like, you're an anxiety expert.
Right.
I didn't realize until she said that I was like a turtle in my shell. Mm. So very aggressive, domineering men make me really small. But I was so reactive. I mean, that probably incident, between the incident and her asking, that was probably 40 minutes.
Okay.
I didn't even know I was in my shell. I was just trying to survive.
Yeah.
But because I tend to get bigger, I don't really recognize when I've gotten really, really, really small.
Wow.
So yeah, that was an interesting one. So it's not always an overreaction. I don't want to call it an underreaction, but it is like you suddenly don't feel safe, but you feel so threatened you don't even know that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
You ever seen that in someone, or does that bring anything into mind?
Yeah, I think it is worth noting the difference between the general way that we show up versus those specific instances. So it's really clear in your example of your tendency to get bigger, to kind of intervene. And this is an example of going the opposite direction. Yeah. I think it's really difficult. It feels similar to how elusive the definition of reactivity is, of really putting words to it. I think that for me, I know that I get smaller anytime I don't know the answer. I don't know what to do. So when I get bigger, it's an anxious response when I think I do know what to do. And I want control. And then getting smaller for me is when I don't know the answer. Or the other theme that I picked up in me is that when there's somebody else in the room that I think is supposed to be the one that's supposed to gain control, I will, I don't know if the word happily shows up there, but I seem to happily kind of wait and see if that person will do what I think they're supposed to do. Yeah. But usually my getting smaller examples end with me then getting bigger, because I get frustrated at the lack of control that's trying to be achieved. And so if I have the time to react, I think that I'll go to my go-to and try and take control.
Okay, so we've given extreme examples of bigger and smaller. You dominating a rec softball guy, reminding him his place. Mine, like surviving like a turtle in my shell. These are extreme examples. Here's where things get really interesting. If you're the only one of your kind in a room, you often find yourself either always getting smaller or juggling between the two. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a teenage daughter, Kaylee, and sometimes she has a bunch of her friends around and I'm the only middle-aged man with a bunch of teenage girls. Terrifying, terrifying. And it's not so much that I'm getting big. It's not a turtle or a domineering. I'm just so aware.
Right.
I'm so self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And so where that gets really interesting for leaders is next time you have a meeting, pay attention to if anybody in the room is the only one of their kind in the room, the only woman, the only man, the only black person, for example. I've had a lot of African-American women talk to me about how often they are the only black person, the only woman, therefore the only black woman in a meeting, and they just say, it's exhausting. I'm just doing extra work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something for leaders to really notice. The other thing, Jimmy, that we teach people is paying attention to how bigger and smaller can become patterns. So let's talk about a staff meeting. What are some patterns that you see where these aren't like nefarious, like the big examples we shared? These are just like everyday habits that staffs get into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, really, anytime you're managing a group, whether it's staff or any kind of group meeting, if you're facilitating or responsible for how the whole thing goes, that's the radar that I've learned to develop in the last decade, is paying attention not just to the content of the meeting, but the way we go about sorting through the content. And so one of those ways is the person in the meeting that just won't say anything the entire time until they're given the floor, usually by either somebody who's facilitating the meeting or there's a long enough pause that they speak up. But then they flip and then they dominate. They can have this big, long dissertation of, it almost feels like all the thoughts they've been collecting for the whole meeting now have the opportunity to come out. And they almost can come out with more authority because now they've been given the floor. Like, oh, this person never talks. Let's make sure that we let them finish. And they get the opportunity to really share their opinions in a pretty powerful way.
Yeah, one of the things we train leaders to look at is what we call it, the veto vote. That's what you're describing. Mm. They may not have a level in the organization, a director or a boss, but the way they communicate gives them power.
Yes.
And that's a great example, is they're so silent that when they speak, they get five votes for your one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What about people that always use a lot of words? Like, I'm one of those people. I'm verbal.
Mm-hmm.
So that could look like me getting bigger in an innocent way.
Right.
But if I'm not aware of that, then I'll force others into a smaller.
Yeah. And it's really difficult if you're trying to find some sort of consensus. And I'm not talking about consensus leadership where you can't make a move unless everybody agrees. But if you are trying to kind of get a feel for the body of Christ or the room, then it's really important to talk about these dynamics and notice them, because they're not inherently good or bad,
yeah.
Right? It's not always that too many words is a problem unless you're unaware of that dynamic and you can just let the people who talk the most get the most votes.
Yeah.
Unless the, you know, veto vote happens, and then that balances the power, I guess, a little bit.
Yeah. And then we have the infamous meeting after the meeting,
mm-hmm.
which I think is evidence of smaller. What I coach leaders on this is a lot of leaders can't stand gossip, and I can't stand gossip either, but I'll say, well, before we start blaming gossip, maybe that group doesn't feel like they have enough safety or power.
Right.
And maybe it's because you are bigger all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I've heard it called the bleachering effect too. It's almost like they have an opinion, but they don't have the courage or the opportunity or power dynamic to be able to share it. And so they have to kind of co-opt people onto their team to feel brave enough to do anything about it. But if that's the avenue in which that's the only way that can happen, then there's the mob that they bring in and saying, hey, we've been talking about this after the meeting for some time, and it comes with almost this ambush or mutiny type environment, which makes it obviously more difficult to deal with than if it had come up, you know, in the meeting.
I mean, we're getting pretty nuanced here, but oftentimes what happens with these kind of phantom mobs is they go from feeling diminished to feeling like super powerful.
Yeah. Look at all these people we have.
Yeah. And a lot of what we talk about is the contagious nature of reactivity. That's a great example. You get a hallway meeting and a Me Too idea,
mm-hmm.
and you've now adopted. I used to do this. I'm not proud of this. I used to work at a large church where if John had an issue with Peter and I didn't have an issue with Peter, and John told me his issue, now I had an issue with Peter.
Yeah.
And God really convicted me of like, hey, like, that is not your problem.
Right.
I'm enmeshed and there's all kinds of complications there, but people can swing wildly from smaller to bigger.
Right.
It's quite tricky.
Yeah, and they co-opt something like a problem they actually do have with Peter. And they now have this issue that didn't bother them so much, but now that I have this other issue, they kind of connect.
Yeah.
You know, I think of Jesus with the woman caught in adultery. You know, it's that group mob, is that they had this poor woman who was the focus of their attack, but their attack had very little to do with her. It had a lot more to do with, they just were uncomfortable with what Jesus was up to. And this was an opportunity, you know, to trap him. I mean, I don't know. Nobody knows what they were carrying in, but it sure seems like their main goal was to trap Jesus, and this was a pawn in their game. And that can happen, I think, with this meeting after the meeting and this kind of contagious anxiety. Because anxiety doesn't displace other anxiety, it just joins the party and stacks.
Yeah.
Then there's this more intense reactivity that's attached to the topic that's really bringing everything else with it. It's almost like when somebody, I'm one of these people, sadly, is I keep a list of wrongs. It's not an actual list, but in my brain, I just add it to the list. Oh, yeah. There's another time that so-and-so has let me down or wronged me. And then when they do it that next time, I bring the emotion attached to all those, yeah, to this one instance. It's super fun being on a podcast because I mean, I'm painting myself to be a stellar human being. Yeah. And it's
you're available for coaching. Yeah, you're available to coach others.
That's right.
No, I mean, this is exactly what it means to be human. And so what we're talking about here, let me just do some recapping. Okay, we're talking about reactivity. Reactivity is an overreaction or an underreaction. What gets tricky about when you get bigger is it doesn't feel like anxiety. It often feels really good. Mm. And then if you've been doing that a long time and your team around you let you get away with it, man, that's often the work you and I do. We go into organizations and that's what we see is years of systemic patterns.
Right.
The beauty is if you listen to this, you're like, man, who could be saved? The beauty is if everyone's motivated to change, you can dissolve these patterns in days or weeks.
Yes.
Okay. So that brings up the smaller, you know, my extreme example of being the turtle in the shell. But really what you're looking for is I no longer feel safe to bring my whole self. And so let's just dig in a bit on smaller, Jimmy. Like I've seen it where people don't give their full opinion. They'll hold back. But I've also seen smaller where they will flatter me rather than tell me the truth.
Right.
So one of our values, our staff values, was we will talk to each other congruent to the way we talk about each other.
Right.
So we really had no problem on our staff that we talk about each other, so long as the way we talk to each other is the same.
Right.
And by that, we don't mean you must always be courteous. We actually mean bring your heated opinion to each other.
Right.
And that's much more clean for us because flattery can be a really sophisticated version of getting smaller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, or that idea of fawn, right? You know, of fight, flight, or fawn. That's where that comes in.
I just heard a new one literally last week, flop.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, like fight. The possum?
Yep, like you just kind of give up and you're in a heap. So, and you're immobile, basically.
You're just done.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you might still be in the meeting, but your brain is no longer engaged. And,
yeah, okay.
That was interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so the final piece we'll talk about with reactivity is it blocks your awareness of God, and that's one of the hardest things to notice, I've found. And I think, Jimmy, it's because there's three categories. There's category one where I am consciously aware that God is with me, like when we light our candle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then there's a second category where I'm just living my mundane life.
Right.
It's not that I'm ignoring God, I'm just kind of being.
Right.
But then there's the third category of that person in the left lane needs to pay.
Right.
And now I've become judged. So I'm thinking out loud right now. I'm not sure if this is true. Is the reason we don't notice God is because we have just taken his seat? Is it that simple?
Yeah. I wonder if it depends on the different wirings, but I know that for me, I would say that's true. I think that it's that you hear people talk about blind rage or like seeing red. I don't know that that's me, but it's that same idea of some precept takes over and you can't shake yourself out of it because you're so sure of either what needs to be done or that you're right or whatever.
Yeah.
And it almost, you know, you almost have to get shaken out of those environments. Like you aren't looking for help or you're not looking for a different path because you think you've already found it. And that's obviously only one side of it. I think that the getting put in despair and wondering where is God is a different, you know, version of the same thing, right?
I think that's right. I think when you're getting smaller, you feel a need to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. Rather, you don't trust that God will protect you or is protecting you.
Yeah, or will do the thing that you think needs to be done when you can't or won't. Or I mean, that's where my brain has been at recently, is this duality of, is it all mine or is it all God's? I think that be still and know that I am God is something that we can do, and then we get prone to doing it all ourselves when really he's called us to great work, but he's called us to do that work under his umbrella of control and safety and security and affection. And it's just really difficult sometimes to stay in that dynamic or lane. We kind of tend to get to extremes, and I think that's where we get stuck.
Yeah. So it does actually raise one more thing. I thought that was the last thing, but now I think this is the last thing. And then we'll do a little musical break, and then we actually have a couple of tools we want to encourage people to try. But it just occurred to me, Jimmy, we do need to talk about what it means to be human-sized, because I do think as you and I are talking about bigger and smaller, they sound like dichotomy, mm-hmm. when they're actually a spectrum.
Right.
And therefore human-sized is not a pinpoint. It's also got lots of room in it.
Yes.
So I'm verbal. I'm just prone to be a big personality anyway. That doesn't mean I'm reactively bigger.
Right.
Yeah. And then some people are just more quiet. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean they're being diminished.
Right.
Tell us a bit of what are you seeing there?
Yeah, that's what I mean with these spectrum type things. I think that anxiety does want us to be black and white thinking of it's either this or it's this. And if you look at it as a spectrum, I think it's important to recognize that it's not a value judgment necessarily of one personality type is better than another. It's paying attention to when it's an automatic reaction that it's like a tool you're using to regain safety or to feel in control or whatever the driver is. It's kind of an extreme use of one of those things, that's where it can be helpful to name or notice, because you can do something about it.
Okay, just a few tools. For those of you who want to do reactivity practice, I hope you've just realized that as Jimmy and I confess our sins, you just never graduate from this work. It's not about becoming a whole different human being. It's simply about not staying in the grip of reactivity. So a couple of the tools that you've taught me through metaphors, the haunted house and the possum, I find these both really helpful. And we'll probably get into them more when we get into stuck patterns, but I still think they're helpful for today. Tell us about the haunted house. What's that?
Yeah, so I don't like scary things, but I don't have a lot of history of going through actual haunted houses except when I was younger. But I've been in them enough to know that you go through and there's these predisposed places where you're going to get scared. They're designed to scare you. And so you go through a haunted house and you're going to jump and be scared and maybe scream. And this is representative of anxiety. It's kind of sneaking up on you, catching you off guard, and you react. But if you were to leave the haunted house and turn around and go right back through again with the intent of going, I'm going to try and be a little bit less reactive, you'd have a better chance, because you know that around the second, you know, corner, the guy's going to come out with a chainsaw, and just the loudness of it is going to startle you. But the helpful thing to me is that you go through a second time, even though you know it's coming, you might still get scared.
Yeah.
And that's reactivity, is that even once we name it, it doesn't mean that now we're unaffected by it. But what you can start doing is, if you went through the haunted house a third and fourth time, you could start preparing yourself to better handle your reactivity. And the goal isn't maybe to walk through and be unaffected. But it is kind of a decent analogy to help us understand that it's not just once I name it, it's gone. But once I name it, I can start to, like you mentioned with the lady and her reactivity, it's lighting a candle preemptively before I'm going to be in a situation where I'm prone to forget that God is actually in control.
I think that's where these tools get really powerful, is every one of us can practice this week. We can actually intentionally drive and watch someone in the slow lane and pay attention to what's going on in us. We can walk into a family dinner or a group of friends. We can keep playing softball. Like all of these things, if we know ourselves, it's this incredible tool to go through that haunted house a different way.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about the possum. This is one of my favorites.
So when I was living in Florida, we found some baby possums that their mother must have gotten run over or something. And so we knew they needed to be taken care of.
You don't think she was on vacation? She might still be alive today.
We actually found,
Okay.
Didn't figure I'd bring that part up. But you know, we knew they were abandoned little babies. And it was funny because I've never interacted with them before this moment, but they put on this show of like, they bare their teeth and they hiss. And my wife and I were actually a little afraid to grab them. So we put on gloves and everything. And when we finally had some person who knew what they were doing, some vet or something, come over and take care of them, she went and grabbed them and they just were, it was all bark and no bite, right? Yeah. It seemed scary, but then when you actually went in and addressed it, they would just flop. Right. Yeah. They would play dead. I mean, they would just kind of go, yeah. And the analogy would be that these fears that we have is that we feel like we're in trouble, or we feel like it demands this high intensity response from us. And as we start looking at these things and observing ourselves, as we, creating an environment like driving in the left-hand lane and for the sociological experiment of figuring out what's happening in me, yeah. We realize that we actually aren't in as big of trouble or threat as our anxiety leads us to believe.
Yeah, that's the beauty of this is so much of the work we do, people are like blown away that the moment they had the courage to poke the possum,
yeah,
the years of dynamic can dissolve.
Right.
So yeah, that's really good. So then that's what you guys are doing this week is you're noticing what makes you reactive. And in 1 week, we wouldn't recommend you're poking the possum necessarily. You're really just noticing mm-hmm. quite a while.
Yep.
But at some point, you're ready to try to get past the other side of it. And so the final tool for reactivity that I'll share, and this is what I learned in chaplaincy, is restrain and reflect. We've talked about this on the podcast before. So you can go back and search this episode. But restrain and reflect, what you're trying to do is you're simply trying to mitigate reactivity. So what Jimmy was telling us at the top of the show was reactivity is essentially some version of autopilot. It just like puts us on a path and takes over. But if you can restrain long enough to reflect, that's where you can really invite God into it. And so for me, as a chaplain, the biggest thing that I had to do was notice my human capacity for suffering and then my impulse to shrink it. Mm-hmm. And the way I would tend to shrink it was with advice, or I'd have to speak into it. That's as a general rule, my first several weeks of chaplaincy, I had the anxious need to say something to make them feel better so I could feel better. That was my reactivity pattern. But if I could restrain that impulse long enough to reflect with God, then I could actually increase my capacity to be quiet and connected to people.
Yeah.
And then what's been shocking to me is that that's still just an ongoing lesson. Like, it's not that I'm this Yoda of restrain and reflect.
Yeah. I will say though, Steve, that I think that, you know, we've been working together for over a decade. And I think that one of the things that's worth saying, I think, is that it feels like the ability, when you see somebody, when I see your ability to, let's say, restrain and reflect, that is obviously where we all want to be, is that we aren't immediately under the slave of our automatic reactions. But I think it starts with noticing after you've been reactive.
Yeah.
And you start going, being willing to take the time to look back on what happened and try and sort out what jumbled mess of emotions has you showing up that way. And that it does take time before you can actually do something about it in the moment.
Yeah.
Kind of feels like the haunted house analogy of that when you get to the point where you can restrain and reflect, if you're just learning these tools and you want to immediately go there, I think that it's a high hill, I guess is what I want to say.
Yeah. And then for those who have been with us for quite a while and you might be thinking, oh, give me something deeper. I think the next tool, Jimmy, is to pay attention to the impact that reactivity is having on you, but also the impact it's having on people you love or your loved ones.
Yes.
I remember several years ago, I took quite a risk with somebody where I asked him to consider doing some deeper work on his own inner critic, because our compliments, like, he was this amazing team member, but he always lived in quite a bit of condemnation, and our compliments couldn't outpace his inner voice of condemnation. And I could see with our team, our attempted solution was more compliments, mm-hmm. when really the path was him doing the difficult, brave work. Mm-hmm. And that's risky, but if he was surprised that his inner critic was affecting us. So often we think our anxiety is just internal.
Yeah.
But really, systems theory teaches us, man, we're all connected. So the reason we all work on being well is also to love our neighbor.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, let's talk about some life-giving habits. A lot of our listeners are familiar with the life-giving list, but I bet many of them aren't in the habit of practicing it. What's a couple of life-giving habits or people you've been around lately?
Yeah, I think that one for me that didn't used to be on my list but is now is fingerstyle guitar. You know, because I was a worship leader for a while, I think that for some reason it was too connected to something I needed to do. Yeah. And now that my role has changed, it's something that now I can go to reactively and proactively to remember that I get to enjoy it. I've been playing Foy Vance's version of the Cheers theme. Yeah. I don't know if he ever published that, but I think
it's just on YouTube.
It's a podcast or something. It's it's pretty easy to play, but it's quite delightful.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. One of mine is I'm currently listening to Annie Downs, and she just has a simple podcast called Let's Read the Gospels.
Okay.
And she's been doing it, I think, since January. And every month she reads the Gospels a different way. Mm-hmm. So like, I'll get it wrong, but like May might've been just the Message version. September is the chronological. So she's in all four Gospels in linear order.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's been neat.
Yeah.
And I try to do that every morning when I'm out with my dog. And for me, you know, we live in Colorado. I try to make use of the mountains in the sense of I get to see them every day. And that's just a reminder, according to the psalmist, from whence our help comes.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, we're two down on the dynamics. We covered assumptions last week, reactivity today. Next episode that you and I will be on together, stuck recurring patterns.
All right.
Should be a good time.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.